We are continuing the series that we've been doing. We started it last week, and we're going to go through the Gospel of John, looking at different witnesses who encountered Jesus and then had an experience with him and then proclaimed something definitive and true about him. And today we're going to be looking at Nathanael and the declaration that he makes. But before we start talking about that, if you want to turn your Bibles to John chapter 1, that's where we're going to be. But before we start talking about that, I'm going to tell you all a story of back in my long, long time ago, in my old high school football days, I played for the Sherman Bearcats in Sherman, Texas. I was a linebacker for the Sherman Bearcats, and we were a decent team sometimes. My junior year, though, was probably our worst year the whole time that I was in high school. Ended up with a 4-6 record, so not a very impressive team that year. And that year, we had a game scheduled, and we played against a team called South Lake Carroll. And I don't know if any of you know anything about Texas high school football or the South Lake Carroll Dragons, but they are absolutely one of the elite programs in the state and in the country, especially at that time. They had a D1 roster, filled with players who were going to go off to play college football, and they were undefeated, and no one had even come close to them. They had won the most recent state championship at the highest level of Texas football, and we were actually not at that. We were a smaller school, not having a very impressive year, and we were going to face each other. I think we were just kind of a tune-up game for them before their conference started, their division game started. However, this is why I wanted to tell this story. When that game started, we came out playing as good as we had played all year long, and I think we caught them by surprise, and we scored a touchdown on our first drive, and then we were able to stop them, and then we were able to score again. We were actually able to build up a pretty decent lead against them. At halftime, we were up 21-17, and, well, I want to end the story right there, because... because that's about all of the good for the rest of that story. No, after halftime, they came back and they built a healthy lead and they went on to have an undefeated state championship season and we went on to not make the playoffs. So, why do I tell that story? Well, it's not the most exciting thing in the world to jump out to a lead and then lose it. But it's to say this. I bet they were not expecting much of a game when they showed up. They may have even asked the question, can any good football team come out of Sherman? They may have asked the question, is there really anything there that we're going to have to compete with? And they came, and it was at least a difficult match for a half. About halfway through the third quarter, I think they got their confidence back. But I think we exceeded expectations, but then also the tragedy is reality set in, and they were a better team with better players, and they ended up winning the game. In John chapter 1, we're about to be introduced to someone who meets Jesus, and he doesn't expect much. All that he knows is that he comes from some small, nothing town that's never produced greatness before. And he asks the question, can any good thing come out of Nazareth? And what happens is his expectations are proven to be wrong. And Jesus is far greater than he expected. In fact, Jesus does something that catches him off guard. And he comes to proclaim something about Jesus. But unlike my story, where that lasted for a half, and then we ended up losing, Jesus says, and by the way, if you're impressed by that, stick around, because even greater things are going to happen. You will see far greater things than what you've already seen. With Jesus, it's not like you're expecting a little, and then he kind of meets your expectations or exceeds them for a little bit, and then reality sets in, and he kind of drifts back off to the background. No, with Jesus, the more time you spend with him, the more you see who he truly is. The more you come to learn of him, the more you come to worship him, the more you come to walk with him, the greater and greater and greater he appears, and the more blown away you actually are. And so turn with me, if you're already there, then just stay there. But in John chapter 1, in verse 43 is where we're going to begin. John the Baptist, we talked about him last week. He's been calling people to come and follow Jesus. Well, some people have followed Jesus. Peter and Andrew have followed Jesus. Well, it says the next day, Jesus purposed to go into Galilee, and he found Philip. And Jesus said to him, "Follow me." Now, Philip was from Bethlehem, the city of Andrew and Peter. And then it says, Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." Now, the first part of that sentence is really impressive. You found the one of whom Moses and the prophets wrote? You found someone that these authors were writing about hundreds or over 1,000 years before he was even born? That tells you you're about to be introduced to someone very special, someone sacred, someone important, right? But then he says, and it's the guy from Nazareth, and he's Joseph's son. Joseph, the carpenter, who you might not necessarily think of as someone who is prominent enough in society to bring about the great expected Messiah or Christ or King or whatever. And so when he hears those two things, "We have found the one of whom Moses and the prophets wrote." That's something good. He's from Nazareth, the son of Joseph. That seems confusing. And that kind of leads us to Nathanael's question, the one that we started off referencing earlier on, verse 46. Nathanael said to him, "Can any good thing come out of Nazareth?" And Philip said to him, "Come and see." I think in that question right there, "Can any good thing come out of Nazareth?" we're being introduced to one of the fundamental problems that is consistent across humanity. I don't think we're very good at predicting where good things will come from. I think we often look for good things in the worst possible places, and we think that we'll find meaning and value and goodness and pleasure and joy and fulfillment in some things that they might give you a momentary fleeting joy, or it might give you momentary fleeting pleasure, but that's not ultimately where the substance is to be found. And at the same time, we can see something that we would expect, "Oh, that's going to be boring," or "That's going to be a waste of time, that's going to be pointless," where actually you end up finding the things that matter the absolute most there. It turns out the thing that matters the absolute most in the whole world came out of the city that no one cared about, no one would have thought of, no one had a good expectation of. Everyone would have looked past it. Nathanael's, "Can really anything good come out of Nazareth?" He had a prejudice against Nazareth that blinded him to the reality of where the good actually was. I think we need to be very careful as we go through this life and we ask ourselves what the ultimate good is. What matters more than anything else? It's not going to be something that we find as we frivolously look for fleeting pleasures. It's not usually going to be something that you find quickly and comfortably in the thing that's the easiest option for you. Sometimes it takes effort. Sometimes it takes work. It often takes looking in places that might not seem the most exciting at first. But then you come to find out that there's actually something true and real and beautiful that's there. What Jesus is about to do is he's about to flip expectations on their head. This is something he does quite a bit, by the way. You have kind of the opposite of this in the book of Revelation. I love the imagery of there's the Ancient of Days who's seated on the throne, who's holding the scroll that no one in heaven and on earth has the authority to open. There's these seals that are keeping the scroll locked. And there's angels around. There's cherubim there. There's strong angels, we're told. Nothing is worthy or able to open the scroll until one of the angels says, "There is one who can open the scroll, one who is worthy to approach the Ancient of Days and take the scroll and to reveal its content. He is the Lion from the tribe of Judah." And you're expecting there to be this prominent, powerful, fierce lion. And it says John looks to see the lion. And you know what he sees instead? A lamb that looks like it's been slain. He sees a lamb, it's alive, but it's like a little lamb covered in blood. That's what he sees instead. And you come to find out, actually, the great victory doesn't necessarily come from the one who looks like the lion. It's the one that looks like the lamb that was slain. He's the one that's been victorious over all. And there's this switch that happens where you're expecting one thing, but you actually find out victory comes in the most unexpected place. The Gospel of John's going to keep that in our minds. It's going to say that the one who gives the great victory and who is the ruler of all is the one who comes from Nazareth. The one who is the great ruler and master of all is the one who gets on his hands and knees and washes the feet of his disciples in John 13. The one who is the living one, who ascends to reign on high, is actually the one who is glorified through humiliation and pain on the cross. It's like everything that you would expect glory and riches and grandeur and someone commanding armies and all of that is flipped upside down, and it's the foot washer from Nazareth who dies on a cross. That's the one where we find our hope and where we find the greatest value and beauty and meaning in this life. He's the one who will fulfill everything that Israel has been hoping for. I mean, keep that in mind. The one who comes from Nazareth, the one who washes the feet, the one who dies on the cross, is actually the one who fulfills every hope and expectation of Israel. So think for a minute about the history of Israel. Think about we often talk about the roles of government, basically, in ancient Israel. You had a king, you had a priest, and you had a prophet. And every once in a while, the prophet might be a priest or a prophet might be a king, but you generally didn't have kings and priests that were the same because priests came from the tribe of Levi and kings come from the tribe of Judah after David and the monarchy. And so they're not going to ever be part of the same family. What we're about to see here in John chapter 1 are ideas of prophet and priest and king all coming together into one, but even in that, they're all still going to be something that leaves you expecting and prepared for something even greater. You might think, oh, there were some great prophets in Israel, prophets like Moses, prophets like Elijah, the greatest prophet you could imagine. You're about to be introduced to someone who's a far greater prophet than even Moses or Elijah. You might say, well, there were some great kings in Israel. You can think about David being a great king. You think about the wealth and wisdom of Solomon. You could think about Hezekiah and his reforms, or Josiah. You know, there weren't too many great kings, but there were a couple of them. Maybe someone. We're about to find the greatest king that Israel has ever had. In fact, he's not only going to be king of Israel, he's going to be king of all heaven and earth itself. Well, what about the priest? You know, the priest, you can look back and you can see some priests who stood for faithfulness. You can see priests who taught people the way of God, right? Well, we're about to be introduced not only to someone who fulfills the role of the priest, but something so much greater. John's about to introduce us to the one who fulfills the role of the temple itself, where all the priests serve. He is the one who is actually the connection between God and man on earth. That's what the priest is supposed to do. The priest is supposed to represent humans to God and gods to humans, and he brings the blessings of God to the people, and he brings the offerings of people to God, and he's kind of the in-between. Well, Jesus is going to be the most direct and profound and powerful in-between you could possibly imagine, being both God and man in one. And all of that can be seen as we read these next few verses right here in John chapter 1. So the question is, can any good thing come out of Nazareth? Buckle up. The greatest thing you could possibly imagine, greater than you could possibly imagine, is about to come out of Nazareth. And so, verse 47, after Philip says to Nathanael, come and see. That is a key invitation in the Gospel of John, and it's something that we need to take very seriously. We might exclude looking at certain things because nothing good can come out of there. Well, at least come and see. And he says, come and see. And then, verse 47, Jesus saw Nathanael coming to him, and he said of him, behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom there is no deceit. Oh, what a great thing for Jesus to say about you. I would hope anyone would be like, oh, if they see me coming, there he is. There's an American you can trust. I was like, hey, I appreciate that. You know, Jesus sees Nathanael coming, and he immediately calls him an Israelite, and he's one who is honest, who is sincere, and who's one who actually, even though maybe he was suspicious and didn't trust that something good could come out of Nazareth, he's honest enough to come and see. He's honest enough to come and check it out. And so he eventually comes, and he's coming with an open and honest heart. And Jesus can see that open and honest heart. I wonder, so there's going to be a direct reference here in a couple of verses to a story with Jacob from the Old Testament. Jacob is actually going to be kind of an important image that we have as we read through the story. And Jacob's name was actually changed to Israel. That's where the name Israel comes from. And all of his sons are called the sons of Israel. And so the word Israel is actually going to pop up a couple of times. That phrase right there, an Israelite, behold an Israelite, that's not a word that appears very much in our New Testament at all. In fact, it's the only time in our Gospels it comes from the mouth of Jesus, where he calls someone an Israelite. It's the only time in the Gospel of John, it's the only time in any of the Gospels that word even appears, the word Israelite. And I'm wondering, if you think back to the first Israel, a guy named Jacob, was he a man in whom there was no deceit? No, actually, that's what his name means, basically. It's like his name means a supplanter. He is someone who was full of deceit. And he deceived his father. He deceived his brother. He in the early part of his life especially, tried to gain advantage through deceit. And I wonder if Jesus is seeing in Nathanael a true and better Israel, or an Israelite. He's an Israelite who doesn't come deceiving, but he's an Israelite in whom there is no deceit. And I think that perhaps is an important preparation for the direction the story is about to take as they meet each other. But simply by saying that, Nathanael responds in verse 48, Nathanael said to him, "How do you know me?" It's like, if you're going to come and tell me that I'm a person in whom there is no deceit, you're pretending like you have some sort of knowledge of me. We don't even know each other. Jesus is going to do this a lot, by the way. He will meet people, and he'll say intimate things about their character or about the history of their lives, and they will walk away perplexed, saying, how in the world does he... When he says this to the woman at the well in John chapter 4, he tells her about her previous life and her husband's. She says, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet." I think that's probably what Nathanael's thinking right now. Especially here, Jesus is going to confirm it in just a second. But he's thinking, how do you know me? And Jesus says in verse 48, "Before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you." Now, I get the impression Jesus wasn't like behind another tree with binoculars. I think Jesus is saying prophetically, "I saw you yesterday, even before we ever met. I've known you. I've seen you. I know who you are. That's how I know you're an Israelite in whom there is no deceit." And Philip, or Nathanael rather, is blown away by this. I would expect him to say, "Sir," like the woman at the well, "I perceive that you are a prophet. You can see things that Noah, that God is revealing things to you in a special and in a unique way. You can do things that no one else can do." But interestingly, that's not what he says. So I do think we're introduced right here. Jesus is a prophet. But Nathanael's actually going to up that in what he says to him. He says, "You're not just a prophet." He says in verse 49, Nathanael answered him, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." Now that word "Son of God," I think, is really deep and really beautiful, and it's used in a lot of ways in the Bible, and it can mean a good number of different things. One thing that it's mean, sometimes it is used for like angelic beings who are before the throne of God. Sometimes those are called in the plural sons of God. Sometimes it is used for Israel itself. So for example, when Israel was enslaved in Egypt and Moses was sent to Pharaoh to go get them, he was told by God to tell Pharaoh, "Israel is my firstborn. Let my son go." Like, Israel is God's son. But also, you see, the representative king of Israel is at times in the Old Testament called the Son of God. God tells, for example, David, he says that you're going to have a son after you, and he's going to be my, I will be like a father to him. He will be a son to me. In Psalm 2, there are these promises about the king of Israel being God's son. Now, I think there's a sense in which, yeah, actually, the king of Israel was considered to be a son of God in a special way, in a way that was meaningful. But then also, there's this unique way that John, in particular, uses the phrase "son of God" that's only applicable to Jesus himself. And I think John has a way of telling stories where you can see the sentence, and then you just start peeling back the layers of meaning behind it all. One of the things that I think Nathanael's probably meaning here when he says, you're the Son of God, you are the King of Israel, I think he probably thinks that those are synonymous terms. Oh, you're the Son of God, like David, or like Solomon, or like one of the kings of Israel. You're the current Son of God and King of Israel. So that it's not necessarily a declaration of eternal divinity or something like that, but that you are, in fact, the king, and as king, you get the title son. And that's something that was given to Solomon, that's something that was given to other kings also. So it is actually a profound declaration that you're the one we've been waiting for, you're the Messiah, you're the king. But as you continue reading the Gospel of John, you come to find out that that phrase or that language of Jesus being the Son of God, it's actually far deeper than simply him being king. And you also come to find out that his kingship does not simply extend to Israel, but actually over all of the world itself. So you come to find out, like in John 5:18, they want to stone Jesus because he's calling God his own father and making himself equal with God. There's this idea that Jesus is the Son of God and that he is equal to God and he shares the same honor as God his Father and he gives life just like God his Father and he is the judge just like God his Father and he shares with God in all these ways. And that's why he can say, he who has seen me has seen the Father. And that's why he can say, I and the Father are one. So Jesus is the Son of God in that the Son and the Father are equal with one another and the Son does the things of his Father. And so as we go through this, I think Nathanael is blown away in saying something really complimentary about Jesus, but it still isn't quite the reality of who Jesus truly is. Jesus has exceeded expectations to be sure, but it's just the beginning. And he's going to see them even more and more and more. And that's why Jesus, in verse 50, Jesus answered and said to him, because I said to you that I saw you under a fig tree, do you believe? Like, that's all it took? I said this one sentence to you about seeing you under a fig tree, and you're ready to believe that I am the King of Israel and the Son of God? He says in verse 50, you will see greater things than these. You are about to be blown away. This is a great introduction to the Gospel of John. That phrase, come and see, the promise, you will see greater things than these. Keep reading the Gospel of John and you will see sign after sign after sign and testimony after testimony after testimony that will take your expectations and expand them beyond measure. Jesus then goes on to say something really interesting in verse 51. He says, and he said to him, truly, truly, I say to you, you will see the heavens opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. What in the world does that mean? Because if you read the rest of the Gospel of John, there's no moment where Jesus like is the Son of Man who is extending from heaven to earth and angels are going up and down on him. How is Nathanael going to see that? Well, this is where, it's important to know a little bit about some Old Testament backdrop to some of these New Testament stories. There is a story in the Old Testament that Jesus is directly referencing when he mentions this, and it's a story about Jacob. Jacob, who was fleeing after deceiving, after being an Israelite who is full of deceit, after being Israel who's full of deceit, he's fleeing his family and he's going off to stay with Laban, his uncle. And along the way, he finds a nice comfy rock and he rests his head on it and he takes a nap. And as he's sleeping, he sees this vision of this ladder or this staircase extending from heaven to earth, and the angels of heaven are ascending and descending on it. That's the exact language that Jesus is using right here. It's like in the Septuagint, it's an exact quotation of the angels ascending and descending on that ladder. He says, that's what they're going to be doing on the Son of Man. So what Jesus is saying is, yeah, I'm a prophet, to be sure. I already showed that. I am king. You are correct to believe that. But I'm actually going to be something that's so much more than that. You might be thinking, oh, he's going to be a priest. Well, yeah, but he's actually going to extend that even further to the idea of the temple itself. Because in that story where Jacob sees that ladder and the angels ascending, he's blown away by it. He names that spot something. He names it Bethel, which literally in Hebrew means house of God. He names that place where the angels were going up the house of God because that ladder is actually doing what the house of God does. It is connecting heaven and earth. It's where the divine and the human meet and interact, and the angels go between them. And so what he's saying is this place right here is a sacred place. This is God's house. Well, what else is called the house of God in the Old Testament? The temple. In John chapter 1 and verse 14, Jesus is introduced to us as the glory of God, the one in whom we see the glory of God as he tabernacles among his people. That's the language of the house of God. It's, at that point, we're talking about a tent rather than a building, but the tabernacle is where God lived. All right? And then you have the temple where God lived. That's Bethel. That's the house of God. And if there's any doubt that that's what John is trying to say, he tells us in 1:14, the glory of God is found in Jesus. That's what you found at the temple. He says Jesus tabernacled among us. That's what God did among his people. Here he says that Jesus is that connection between heaven and earth. It's called the house of God. And then in the very next chapter, Jesus goes to the temple and he starts flipping tables over there and everyone's confused and in a stir. Why are you doing this? What's your authority for doing this? And Jesus says, destroy this temple and in 3 days I will rebuild it. And John removes any question about the interpretation when he says he was speaking about the temple of his body. You know what we're being told here? We're being told that the temple may have been the place where you thought you could go to find the priests and where you thought you could go to find repentance and forgiveness through offerings and where you went to go find the presence of God and to worship him. But with the coming of Jesus, you don't find those things at a brick and mortar temple anymore. You find those blessings in the living, breathing, speaking Son of God himself. You find those things in Jesus. He's where you go to find the presence and the glory of God. He is where you go to worship and praise God. He is where you go to find forgiveness of sins. Is he a prophet? Absolutely. Is he a king? Greater than any you could imagine. Is he a priest? Yes, he's the high priest, but he's also the very temple of God on earth itself. And as he ascends to sit at the right hand of God, we, as his body and as his people, continue to be his body on earth. We continue to be that presence of God on earth. We continue to be where the temple is found on earth. Can any good thing come out of Nazareth? Well, we're here today, right now, praising and worshiping God because of something that came out of Nazareth. And we are, in our praise and in our worship, trying to continue that goodness that was found in Nazareth on that day. Yes, something good can come out of Nazareth. And it's not something where it's good for a little while, and then when the second half of the game comes, you get blown out. This is one where victory is assured. This is one where Jesus, yes, he came out of Nazareth. Yes, he washed feet. Yes, he died on a cross. But through love and service and self-giving sacrifice, he actually embodied all that God was, all that God is, and all that God calls us to be. Thus, God highly exalted him. Thus, he was raised from the dead. Thus, he does sit at the right hand, reigning as king over all heaven and earth, with all authority in heaven and on earth right now. And that is something that gives us hope, and that is something that gives us confidence, and it's something that I think should behoove and motivate every one of us to look to him, to turn our lives towards him. And as Jesus started this story with a call to Philip to follow him, are you following Christ? Are you following the prophet, priest, and king? Are you following the embodiment of God on earth? Now's your chance to do so by naming him as the Lord of your life, turning your life into conformity with his will, repenting of the way you had been living and where you had been trying to find the good, and seeking the good that is found in him, having your sins washed away in baptism and living for him from this point forward. If we can help you do that, you can please talk to some of our elders in the library in the back. They'd be happy to study with you, to meet with you. Or if you have the need, you can come and sit on the front row while we stand and as we sing.